the dawn of television, many dramas, serials, soap operas, and even quiz shows made the transition from radio to television. In the latter half of the 20th century, as television completely took over the dramatic broadcast landscape, that's been a very rare occurrence. But there are exceptions. And here we have one of the grandest exceptions of all time, one that will surely last till the end of life, the universe, and everything. One that will surely go down in the annals of the Encyclopedia Galactica, the sister publication to... Hi, this is Rennie Mann with Screen Gems. Welcome to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It seems that there's no definitive backstory as to how The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy came about, as even author and creator Douglas Adams admits to telling slightly differing stories too many times. But what we can generally understand is that Adams came up with the idea of doing this project while lying drunkenly in a Belgian or French field on a hitchhiking trip around Europe. He surely had a lonely planet or Fromm's guide or whatever guide was in vogue at the time by his side.
I was completely broke. Very little I'd tried to turn my hand to had sort of worked at all. And one of the things I was continually trying to persuade people to be interested in was the idea of doing comedy science fiction. And nobody was interested at all. And I went to one person after another with one version of the idea after another. And then oddly enough, one producer I happened to know, Simon Brett, and he was one of the people I hadn't approached with this, quite by chance, came to me and said, what I think would be a great idea is doing comedy science fiction, and I think I have a feeling you might be the person to do it. And then I remembered this thought I'd had years and years earlier when I'd been lying drunk in a field in Innsbruck about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I thought of Ford Prefect as a researcher for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And that was when the whole thing really began to come together.
Supposedly, in the original six-part series, each episode was going to culminate in the Earth's destruction, in a different way each time. But Adams thought it might be a little more funnier if the Earth blew up at the start of the series. And thus, a legend was born. To say it has been a near-on 30-year phenomenon would be an understatement to extreme. The movie coming out this month is in fact the 9th loose incarnation of the story. There was the original radio show, a record album, this television series, the novels, computer game, stage show, comic book, and even a towel. And fittingly, even with Adam's untimely death in 2001, that's not the end of the story. As most people are aware, the concept began as the radio series for BBC 4 and first broadcast in 1978. I actually remember hearing it in Melbourne, Australia, on the ABC. I was aware of this British phenomenon, was already a fan of that brand of British humour made most recognisable on The Goon Show, movies such as Richard Lester's Bedsitting Room, and of course, all the Pythons, whether on TV or cinema. I taped the series on compact cassettes, shared the tapes with my friends, and perhaps had a hand in spreading the phenomenon around Australia. There is, in fact, a direct relationship between Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the Pythons, and Arthur Dent, or should I say, Simon Jones. First up, Adams and Jones were at Cambridge together, and were members of the Footlights Amateur Drama Club, the revue troupe that counts as some of its members at various times Jonathan Miller, Peter Cook, David Frost, Tim Brooke Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Chapman, Stephen Fry, and the list just goes on and on and on. Adams worked with Chapman, attempting to write some projects together in the early 70s, and the only thing of note that came from that collaboration was a little comedy show called Out of the Trees, with the star being none other than Simon Jones. Yes, it's that British brand of self-deprecating humour that shines. The humour of language.
On this particular Thursday, things were moving through the ionosphere many miles above the surface of the planet. Several huge, yellow, slab-like somethings, huge as office blocks, silent as birds, they hung in the air exactly the same way that bricks don't.
The the humour of ludicrous plots.
Arthur Dent, a perfectly ordinary Earthman, was rather surprised when his friend Ford Prefect suddenly revealed himself to be from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse and not from Guildford after all. He was even more surprised when a few minutes later the Earth was unexpectedly demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass. But this was as nothing to their joint surprise when they were rescued from certain death by a stolen spaceship manned by Ford's semi-cousin, the infamous Zaphod Beeblebrox, and by Trillian, a rather nice young astrophysicist Arthur once met at a party in Islington.
The humour of silly and surreal sound effects, something that was absolutely essential for a radio series. And it's the humour that penetrates our own language and culture. The goons gave us the dreaded lurgy, the pythons gave us, and now for something completely different, and Hitchhikers has given us, mostly harmless, don't panic, and of course that favourite of numbers, 42. I mean, what other series can maintain that the Earth is just one big mice-made experiment, where the key walking and talking robot is an advertisement for Prozac, where doors open and close with an attitude, and where digital watches, well, in those days, who couldn't live without their digital watch? In terms of where this TV series fits into the phenomenon, as we all know, the radio series was a huge success, and then Adams went about writing the original novel, as well as working on a live stage show adaptation. The BBC greenlit the TV series after the stage show was up and in the midst of Adams completing the first novel. Therefore, the TV series in fact became an adaptation of the original radio show. But it should be recognised that a lot of the gags had basically already been workshopped for the radio program and some of the stage work. I mean, what other series can maintain that the Earth is just one big mice-made experiment, where the key walking and talking robot is an advertisement for Prozac, where doors open and close with an attitude, and where digital watches, well, in those days, who couldn't live without their digital watch? In terms of where this TV series fits into the phenomenon, as we all know, the radio series was a huge success, and then Adams went about writing the original novel, as well as working on a live stage show adaptation. The BBC greenlit the TV series after the stage show was up and in the midst of Adams completing the first novel. Therefore, the TV series in fact became an adaptation of the original radio show. But it should be recognised that a lot of the gags had basically already been workshopped for the radio program and some of the stage work. It should also be recognised that each incarnation of the guide are all variations of the same, but no two works are exactly alike. Adams mostly thought that the series of books, the six books that make up his trilogy, are the definitive works. But the reality is, well, who cares which is better? Just that this TV series is a delight. Although it was a very peculiar structure for a TV series, as I said previously, much of the humour was already worked. Adams, though, is adamant that if he wrote the TV series from scratch, it would have been very, very different.
One of the interesting problems, of course, is that we were transferring it from radio to television, and there was a lot of
stuff in it that was there specifically because it was a radio programme. For instance, the narrator. If we'd been doing it on television to start with, it would never have occurred to me to put in a narrator. But in the radio show, the narrator had been an integral part of the character of the programme, so the narrator had to be in the television series. Something that started out as being a problem that arose from transferring to radio, from radio to television, turned out in many ways to be one of the most original and, I think, rewarding aspects of making the television show.
We also have to recognise that this was the BBC. The BBC of Quatermass, Doctor Who, my beloved Blake 7, and Red Dwarf. And interestingly enough, like Red Dwarf, Hitchhikers was produced by the BBC comedy department, not its drama department. But what I'm actually driving at is that there was never much money for special effects. Remember, this show was made 13 years after Star Trek ended, 4 years after Star Wars opened, and Hitchhikers were still using 25-buck glass mats in the new era of great special effects. But the cheesiness of the special effects is part of the charm of the series. That was part of the charm of the original Doctor Who. The humour or drama had to overpower the look and the action. No big money spent on uniforms and costumes. After all, Arthur Dent, the lead of the leads, spends the entire series in his pyjamas and bathrobe. Yes, the humour has to be larger than the look and the action. And it is. Well, what's it all about? Okay. Unbeknownst to the humans residing on the planet, Earth was in fact built by the Magrathians, the planet builders of old, under contract for a race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings who actually took on the form of white mice when in this dimension. That's right. Man had always believed he was the master of the planet, but he was wrong. Very wrong.
It is an important and popular fact that things are not always what they seem. For instance, on the planet Earth, man had always assumed that he was more intelligent than dolphins because he had achieved so much. The wheel, New York, wars, and so on. Whilst all the dolphins had ever done was muck about in the water having a good time. But conversely, the dolphins believed that they were more intelligent than man for precisely the same reasons. Curiously enough, the dolphins had long known of the impending demolition of Earth and had made many attempts to alert mankind to the danger. But most of their communications were misinterpreted as amusing attempts to punch footballs or whistle for titbits, so they eventually gave up and left the Earth by their own means, shortly before the Vogons arrived. The last ever dolphin message was misinterpreted as a surprisingly sophisticated attempt to do a double backwards somersault through a hoop whilst whistling the Star Spangled Banner. But in fact, the message was this: so long and thanks for all the fish.
The race had already built a super-duper computer that they called Deep Thought to come up with the ultimate answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything. And after some eons of years of computing, Deep Thought came up with the answer. 42. The race was stunned. They just couldn't work out what Deep Thought was on about, until he came back and said that they were confused because they hadn't actually worked out the ultimate question yet. The mice went back and built a bigger and better computer, which was in fact planet Earth and everything on it, and set about the 10 million year program to come up with the ultimate question. And as these things go...
And then, one day, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl, sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rickmansworth, suddenly realized what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could be made a good and happy place. This time it was right, it would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone, the Earth was unexpectedly demolished to make way for a hyperspace bypass, and so the idea was lost forever.
That's right. The mice never thought to check the municipal plans on display at Alpha Centauri for the last 50 years that clearly outlined the destruction of the planet to make way for the bypass, unless, of course, anyone protests. And obviously, no one did. The story unfolds through the eyes of one Arthur Dent, a Mr. Average nobody from Islington, and his interstellar pal, Ford Prefect, who had been residing on Earth as a researcher over the last 15 years for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
How long have we known each other, Arthur?
5 years, maybe six. Most of it seemed to make some kind of sense at the time.
All right. How would you react if I told you that I'm not from Guildford after all, but from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse?
I don't know. Why? Do you think it's the sort of thing you're likely to say?
Drink up. The world's about to end.
This must be Thursday. I never could get the hang of Thursdays.
After 15 years on the planet, prefix listing on planet Earth was updated from the single word harmless all the way to mostly harmless. Prefix brought Dent with him when escaping the destruction of the planet, and the story is unfurled to them and the audience by their interactions with others and, of course, by the guide, which both serves as the narrator of the story and the dry delivery man of the insane workings of the galaxy, basically a lot of funny bits. In fact, the narrator constantly and welcomely interrupts the drama with an encyclopedic tray of delicious morsels.
So this is it? We're going to die?
I wish you'd stop saying that.
One of the things that Ford Prefect had always found hardest to understand about human beings was their habit of continually stating and restating the very, very obvious, as in, it's a nice day, or you're very tall, or so this is it, we're going to die. At first, Ford had formed a theory to account for this rather strange behavior. If human beings don't keep exercising their lips, he thought, their mouths probably seize up. After a while, he abandoned this theory in favor of a new one. If they don't keep exercising their lips, he thought, their brains start working. In fact, this second theory is more literally true of the Belcerebon people of Cacrophoon Kappa.
Yes, the plot is ludicrously thin, but it's the colour and the texture of the filling that's so rich and delicious. And of course the performances. As we've already discussed, Arthur Dent is played by Simon Jones. Well, the role was written for him, in fact. He premiered Dent on radio and reprises him in this TV series. Jones has an eclectic resume of film and television from both sides of the Atlantic. For TV, as well as Hitchhikers, he's appeared in Brideshead Revisited, The News is the News, Tattingers, One Life to Live, Cosby, Newhart, Blackadder 2, Murder, She Wrote, and, I believe, a role in Paul Reiser's sitcom Mad About You, although I can't get that confirmed anywhere. In film, Privates on Parade, Monty Python's Meaning of Life, Terry Gilliam's Brazil and 12 Monkeys, Green Card, and many others. Did I mention it was a very eclectic resume? He always brings that British upper-class twit character to his roles, which of course is Arthur Dent.
This is my idea of a spaceship. All gleaming metal, flashing lights, everything. Oh! I wonder what'll happen if I press this button.
Don't.
Oh.
What happened?
A sign lit up saying, please do not press this button again.
David Dixon's Ford Prefect is another matter. He has a wonderful collection of British classics under his belt, mainly TV, from Z-Cars to The Sweeney, Rock Follies, A Touch of Frost, The Bill, and of course some Shakespeare, in fact as Ariel in The Tempest for the BBC's ambitious project The Complete Dramatic Works of Shakespeare. Dixon was not in the original radio series. There the part of Ford Prefect was played by Geoffrey McGiven. But it was concluded by Adams and director of the TV series Alan Bell that McGiven just didn't look weird enough.
He said, well, yeah, we cast you because you've got weird eyes, David, but would you mind wearing these contact lenses? Bit of purple contact lenses. And I thought, well, you know, purple contact lenses might come in useful for, at some point, you know, going to see the bank manager or something like that. Maybe purple contact lenses in and ask for a couple of grand.
Don't knock it, it worked.
Dixon brought a whimsical schoolboy attitude to the role, which was obviously helped by dressing him in a schoolboy blazer. The whole issue of casting the TV series is filled with folklore. It is said that Adams wanted to keep the entire cast from the radio series for the TV version, and Bell wanted to change everyone. And it seems there was a compromise of sorts. The role of Trillian was originally played by Susan Sheridan, but it is said she was, quote, unavailable, unquote, for the TV series. Instead, they cast Sandra Dickinson, and she gave the role a wonderful Judy Holliday, born yesterday, ditzy blonde makeover. A nice touch for a leggy astrophysicist.
What's going on?
According to Zaphod, Magrathea is this legendary planet which no one else seriously believes in. And now we're going to land on it.
Oh. Is there any tea on this spaceship?
Her TV roles go back to Doctor at Sea, and she continued playing the ditzy blonde in movies such as Superman 3 and Space Truckers. Now, on the one hand, to the delight of all his fans, Mark Wing Davey reprises his radio role as Zaphod Beeblebrox, the two-headed, three-armed, sometime bandit, sometime galactic president. On the other hand, or should I say the other hand, Mark Wing Davey does a wonderful job at making us believe that the piece of rubber attached to his neck is actually, well, not much more than a piece of rubber attached to his neck, but he does it so well. As with so many of the British performers of the time, Davey does a wonderful job moving between film and TV, comedy and drama. He also starred in Out of the Trees, as well as An Englishman Abroad and the BBC's Henry VI, plus many others. As Zaphod, he brings us the wonderful balance between a raving lunatic and a fast-talking crazy to the screen.
There's an opening in the ground.
Looks like a tunnel.
Okay, guys, here we go. Let's get on in there. Into the interior of the planet. That is where we have to go. Down into the very depths of time itself, where no man has trod these 5 million years. We are not going to be great. We are not going to be amazing. Amazingly amazing.
Sounds awful.
Can it, Marvin?
And then, of course, there's Peter Jones, the narrator, the voice of the guide. It is said that when they were originally casting the role for the radio show, the brief was to look for a Peter Jonesy type of voice. They searched high and low, even tried Michael Palin, who turned down the role, and just couldn't find a Peter Jonesy voice. Then someone had the bright idea, well, why don't we try Peter Jones? And that's how legends are born. Jones relished the role, on radio, on TV, even though he actually didn't quite get it all. Jones was a founding regular participant in the BBC 4 classic radio comedy quiz show Just a Minute, which I only mention because I actually still listen to it on the BBC World Service. And this was another instance where Jones bravely admitted he never quite got it. Jones has had a long and distinguished career in TV and cinema. In TV, he popped up in the cream of British broadcasting, including The Avengers, The Rag Trade, The Goodies, Man About the House, Rumpole, Minder, The Bill. And in the movies, he's credited with over 75 appearances in such classics as Cairo Road, The Magic Box, A Day to Remember, The Red Dress, Carry On Doctor, Return of the Pink Panther. Just too many to do justice to. There would be no guide without the slightly bemused, authoritative tones of Jones, who also, acting as the narrator, gives us a wonderful introductory summation before each episode.
Far out, in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy, lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper. Which is odd, because on the whole, it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy.
And so the problem remained. And lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place. And some said that even the trees had been a bad move and that no one should ever have left the oceans.
Although Alan Bell directed this TV series, it was still all Douglas Adams, who is just synonymous with everything to do with The Hitchhiker's Guide. Unfortunately, Adams died prematurely before the new feature started production, but he was very involved in the script. Since the original radio show, which formed the basis of this series, the original novel has turned into a 6-volume trilogy. 2 more radio series have been produced and aired, the second series in 1980, and the third series 24 years on in late 2004, with an adaptation that followed the instructions set by Adams before he died. It is expected that a 4th and 5th series will follow this year and next. But getting back to this TV series, it was originally broadcast by the BBC in January and February of 1981. There were 6 episodes of 35 minutes each. When some of the PBS stations originally aired the series in the US, they recut it into 7 30-minute episodes, which did mess up a lot of the intros and the dramatic structure. It was a bit of a broadcast mess. This DVD out at the moment is the definitive edit of the original series, and everything just works. There's also some wonderful material on the second bonus disc, a little of which I've used in this program. The Hitchhiker phenomenon will never leave us. Like a select few of other favourites, it will live longer than its creator, or any of us for that matter. We'd like to think it will last till the end of the universe itself, and it'll be at that time when we can finally say, so long and thanks for all the knishes. Oops, sorry about that. This was Rennie Mann with Screen Gems and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.